Ladies and gentlemen of the New Jewish Business Network, Baruchim Habaim, welcome. I know that you are very busy, you're all business people and so on, and I'll try not to speak for too long. And as Henry VIII, I think, said to his six wives, I won't keep you around too long, so we'll kind of hope that'll happen. You know, I was in Jerusalem recently, and I read an inscription at Yad Vashem, and it said, forgetfulness leads to exile, while remembrance is the secret of redemption. And our Torah, our Bible, is filled with the admonition to remember. Remember the Sabbath day. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt. Remember to keep my commandments. And Yizkor, which we say, you know, at each of our holy days, where we remember the lives and good deeds of those who've gone before us. And Yom HaZikaron, the day every year, right close to Yom HaTzmaut, you know, the day of liberation of the State of Israel, where we remember the brave men and women who gave their lives in defense of the Jewish State of Israel. Now today I'm going to share some of my memories of one of the best kept secrets of the War of Independence, that of the Machal Volunteers. Actually, you pronounce it pretty well, Herb, the second time. Okay. Machal is the Hebrew acronym for Mitnadvei Chutz La'aretz, which means volunteers from outside of Israel. We were the guys who came in from other countries to Israel. For reasons that are still obscure, the Israeli government censored all mention of the foreign volunteers during the War of Independence, and newspapers were not permitted to report our presence until the war was long over. And because of this media blackout, very few knew then or know now about this rather special group. Now, when the Machal volunteers left the safety of home and family and made their way by an underground clandestine route to Israel back in 1948, they went to fight for a country they had never seen and a language they did not speak. But they weren't speaking for some unknown strip of land. They were fighting for our ancient homeland. You know, 4,000 years ago, Abraham settled in that land, and with the contract that he made, according to the legends and stories, you know, that was our land in perpetuity. And impelled by this historic and traditional attachment, we Jews have striven in every generation to reestablish ourselves in our ancient homeland. And even though we've been, you know, that country was invaded, and these superpowers of ancient times, you know, forced us into exile, we've always returned whenever we could. And we've never given up our historical rights to this land of ours. And there are places, and we should know this, there are places in the Galil and the Golan where Jews never left this country, who have always been there. So don't believe the stories that we were kicked out and are finally coming back as colonials. We're not colonials. We've always lived there, and this is our country. And this physical and emotional attachment has been summed up in vision and hope at the end of every Passover celebration. And you remember saying it, I'm sure, last Passover. We've been saying it for 3,000 years. L'shana haba'a Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem. And that was the wish. We didn't always get there, but that was the wish, and we've said it for 3,000 years. And today, this return to Zion is still going very strong. For as I speak, 41% of all Jews worldwide are living in Israel. And new Olim are making Aliyah every year. Historian Barbara Tuchman wrote recently, quote, Israel is the only nation in the world that is governing itself in the same territory, under the same name, and with the same religion and the same language as it did 3,000 years ago. And no matter which part of the world we live in, when we pray, it is to Jerusalem that we turn. And Jerusalem, with all its history and memories, continues to serve as the emotional and spiritual center of the Jewish people. You know, I find it, you know, somewhat revealing that the Arabs who claim such an attachment to our holy city, turn their backs to Jerusalem when they pray. They turn to Mecca. Jerusalem is mentioned 700 times in our Bible, and not even once in their Quran. And while David made Jerusalem his capital, and Solomon built our first temple there, Muhammad, contrary to fanciful and wishful Muslim claims, never once set foot in Jerusalem. So I'm just trying to set the history straight of our great city of Jerusalem. You know, and this compelling return to Zion, in a phrase, Zionism, whether religious or political, has not always been well understood by others. In 1917, a member of the British House of Lords asked Chaim Weizmann, and Chaim Weizmann is probably one of the most responsible modern figures to help us establish the Jewish state. He asked Chaim Weizmann, "Why do you Jews insist on Palestine when there are so many undeveloped countries which you could settle in more conveniently?" And Weizmann replied, "That is like asking, like me asking you, why you drove 30 miles to visit your mother last Sunday when there are so many old ladies living on your street." You know, and our connection to Jerusalem is very strong. How many of you have visited Israel? Okay, if you went to Israel, you went to Jerusalem. And if you went to Jerusalem, you went to the Kotel, the wall. And if you went to the wall, you put a note in that wall. And that reminds me of this rabbi. There's always a rabbi, you know, that comes into this. He meets a couple and asks them, "How many children do you have?" "Well, we weren't blessed with any yet," they tell him. "Okay, let me write down your names and place a note in the Kotel for a blessing." 5 years later, he meets the wife again and asks, "So how's the family?" "Well, Rabbi, we were blessed with 10 children, 2 sets of twins, and 2 sets of triplets." "Amazing. I would like to congratulate your husband. Where is he?" "Oh, he's in Israel," she replies. "What's he doing there?" the rabbi asks. "He is still looking for the note you placed in the wall." Well, again, getting a little bit back to the history, after World War I, when the Ottoman Empire, you know, was defeated, the British were granted the mandate for Palestine in 1920. The mandate meant basically you look after this place and you prepare it to govern itself. But in place of that, the Brits turned Palestine into their own colony, and for 30 years it was a colony of the British. Not only that, but they took 80% of the Jewish homeland and created the Palestinian state of Transjordan, which they gave to their buddy, you know, Abdullah, and entry was strictly forbidden to the Jews. And then further attempting to placate the Arabs and to, you know, protect their oil supplies and so on, They published a white paper in 1939, essentially closing Palestine to further Jewish immigration, thus condemning thousands of Jews to the Nazi death camps. But in spite of this British betrayal, the Jews of Palestine, you know, all wanted to help the Allied war effort, and they did. And even after the war, when finally the history of the death camps began to circulate, began to become known, the British policy didn't change. And all the boats and ships that were trying to get these refugees from the death camps to Palestine were turned away by the British, who didn't want to offend, you know, the Arabs. And there was one particular boat, and you know the story, there was a book, there was a movie, The Exodus, 1947, where 4,500 refugees from the death camps packed on board, and inside of Haifa, they could see their promised land, were forced back to Hamburg and re-interned in 2 former German concentration camps. Well, the journalists who saw this struggle where the British Marines jumped on board with tear gas, grenades, and rifles, and streams of water, and beat up the crew, and beat up the Jewish refugees. When they saw all this, the outcry was amazing, and the British became very embarrassed, and there was a stunning victory for the Zionist cause. We have to say that the Exodus, you know, event was one of the turning points in Jewish history, because they decided, the Brits decided to give up the mandate for Palestine, turn the whole thing over to the UN. And what the UN did in November of 1947 was to say, let's have two states. You know, we'll have a Jewish Palestinian state and we'll have an Arab Palestinian state, you know, living side by side. Now, I have to tell you that 75% of the Jewish state that was partitioned, going to be partitioned, you know, was basically made up of desert. And about 20 of the very well-established kibbutzim settlements would be lost. And even worse, Jerusalem was to be internationalized. But the Jews said, it's not a perfect plan, but yes, we'll accept the partition plan. Now, the Palestinian Arabs, who it's been said many times, never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity, vehemently rejected the proposal, the two-state proposal, and went to war rather than accept the historical and political reality of a Jewish state. Now, we dance the horror in the streets. You know, in England, where I come from, and I met volunteers who came to Israel, and they told me that in Basel, this very, very conservative, you know, Christian Swiss city, when they danced in the streets, all the Swiss gaped to them. They couldn't believe that these Jews were dancing this strange dance called the horror in the middle of Basel and so on. But our joy was great. But at the same time, we realized that when the Brits pull out their 100,000 troops, you know, war is going to happen, and war is going to be pretty, pretty terrible for this small Jewish state. And on Friday the 14th, just before Shabbat, 1948, 400 Jews waited in Tel Aviv at the Art Museum. That was the most secure building in Tel Aviv, under the watchful gaze of a Haganah, you know, detachment, to listen to another great, wonderful Zionist hero, David Ben-Gurion, announced the establishment of the Jewish State of Israel. But the reality on that day was stark and grim. General Azam Pasha, the head of the Arab League, declared a jihad, and I know we all know the term today, a holy war against the Jews. And I'll quote, "This will be a war of extermination and momentous massacre which will be spoken of like the Mongolian massacres and the Crusades," unquote. The Mufti of Jerusalem, now you should remember or know, the Mufti of Jerusalem was a close friend of Hitler. He lived in Germany during the war. He was a confidant and helped Hitler with his final solution, what to do with the Jews. And Haji Amin al-Husseini, the Mufti of Jerusalem, said, "I declare a holy war, my Muslim brothers, murder the Jews, murder them all." And Damascus Radio called on all Arabs to, quote, "undertake the liberation battle that will tear the hearts and bodies of the hateful Jews and trample them into the dust." To hear Ahmadinejad and his Hamas and Hezbollah lackeys in Gaza and Lebanon, the message has not changed one iota. Now, when we think of the Israel Defense Forces today, we think of one of the most dedicated and powerful armies in the world. And most military analysts would probably agree that Israel's Top Gun pilots are probably the best pilots in the world or close to it. But the situation on May 15, 1948, when the British mandate ended, and five very powerful, very well-equipped Arab armies, Egypt, Transjordan, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq, comprising over 200,000 regular soldiers, many more thousands in reserve, and when they invaded the new Jewish state, remember too, they were supported by close to 1 million local Arabs, and the local Arabs had guns and worked with guns since childhood. They came in large numbers. They had about 150 of the latest tanks. They were supplied by Britain and France. They had aircraft, bombers, about 350, you know, modern tanks and armored vehicles, many long-range guns, plenty of ammunition, and an abundance of confidence. So much confidence, in fact, that the Egyptians, assured of a very, very quick victory, had actually printed a postage stamp, and I've got a copy, if not in this book, in my other reference material, printed a postage stamp that had victory over the Zionist enemy, printed ahead of the war, ahead of the battle. They were so confident that they were going to wipe Israel off the face of the map within 2 weeks. Now, let me also kind of tell you that 9 days after Israel declares its independence, America, Britain, France, all the Western powers imposed a complete, you know, blockade, if you like, of the area. No weapons were allowed to come into this area at all. There was an embargo. But this had almost no effect on Egypt, on Jordan, on Iraq, on Lebanon, because they were supplied by Britain and France. These were their patrons, if you like. But for Israel, it was a completely different story. They had no one to send them arms, to give them modern arms whatsoever. And let me tell you what Israel had, because there are so many false stories that I hear even today, even by some so-called Israeli historians who paint a picture that we fought the war with all the modern arms we could wish for, completely untrue. I was there on the ground. I know exactly what we had. Now, when war started, Israel didn't have an army. It had three semi-autonomous paramilitary groups, each with its own political loyalty and its own agenda. We had the politically centrist Haganah, which had about 30,000 part-time civilian soldiers, but only about half of that number really could be deployed in any military fashion. We had 5,000 in the Palmach, the left wing, if you like, folks from the kibbutzim, both men and women, because women fought in the Palmach, and very bravely too, and the right wing Irgun and Lehi with about 4,000. There's also a home guard made up of older people, Gadna, the youth kind of brigade for 15 to 17 year olds who weren't allowed in action, and Nachal, fighting pioneer youth that guarded the border settlements. But in point of fact, the Jewish population of Palestine was around 650,000 in 48. And every one of them was really part of the war effort. But I have to tell you, they were poorly trained, they had no military experience, they lacked weapons. But they were mobilized one way or another to kind of do what they could to combat, you know, the invasion. And I looked at it just the other day, and I thought to myself, Israel has 650,000 Jewish farmers, accountants, shopkeepers, scholars, but a group like this, okay? You know, you're not military trained, and you have to face 40 million militant Arabs bent on your destruction. I mean, it was really a shattering thought. Let me point again, or let you know, what the Jewish state had in 1948. Now, the bravery of the Israelis, no one can question. But very few of the Palestinian Jews fought in any army. A few of them did fight in the British Army. And in the end, towards the end of World War II, there was the Jewish Brigade. In fact, good friends of mine fought in the Jewish Brigade, and so on. So there were some that had some military training, but very few. And they didn't have, so most Palestinian Jews had no experience fighting a conventional war against tanks, against airplanes, against bombers, against long-range artillery, against trained troops. They really didn't. We had no tanks, no military planes, no modern artillery. Rifles. We only had about 13,000 rifles for the entire country. And they were all over the place. In fact, if we thought there was an attack in the north, we sent all the rifles north. And then when we thought there'd be an attack in the south, we sent the rifles south. We only had ammunition for 3 days of fighting. I mean, this is not hearsay. This is not some historian writing his surmise. I was there. I know exactly what was going on. We did have a few single-engine planes. They were sport planes. They were Piper Cubs in the main. And they weren't intended for combat. But you know, our pilots, our volunteer pilots, our Machal pilots, fired machine guns, terribly dangerous. They fired machine guns out the side of the plane when they were attacked by the much better Spitfires and so forth that the Egyptians had. Our bombs, we dropped Molotov cocktails. You all know what they are, bottles with gasoline or whatever. We dropped Molotov cocktails and hand grenades and even empty seltzer bottles out of these planes. Can you imagine what the seltzer bottles were all about? Well, this is a secret which you shall now know. They made a terrible howling noise when they were dropped from the planes. And the Egyptians actually really, really hated the noise and thought they were some devilish weapon, that they were empty seltzer bottles screaming down at them. Let me read. This comes from my book. No one knew his right name. They called him the Mad Russian. Every night, just before sundown, he climbed into an old Piper Cub and flew off towards Gaza. In his lap were 24 hand grenades, and in the rear seat, a burlap bag filled with empty bottles. These are the soda bottles, the seltzer bottles. He dived down to treetop level and hurled the grenades at the Egyptian troops. After exhausting the grenades, he would reach behind him for the burlap bag and bombard the enemy soldiers with the empty bottles. And one day he did not return. When we got some larger surplus planes, we had people here in the States that were buying old planes for us, C-46s and Dakotas, planes that were for the scrap heap. And we bought them, and we had people repairing them and so on, and we finally got some larger planes. And when we got these larger planes, we took the strongest guys we could find. These are usually Israelis. Nothing against the American volunteers and so on, but the Sabres were really tough guys. We'd find the strongest guys we could find. We'd strap them in by the open cockpit door so they wouldn't be pulled out by the slipstream, because that almost happened a couple of times. And we'd put a 50-pound bomb on their lap. And they were actually called bomb chucker outers. When they were told by the pilot, chuck bombs out, and they would chuck the bombs out of the plane. That's how we bombed the enemy. We didn't have any bomb sites. That's how we did it, with bomb chucker outers. Now, in 47-48, about 4,000 volunteers, mostly from Western and English-speaking countries, left the safety of their homes and loved ones, made their way by this underground secret route to a DP camp in the south of France, Grand Arenas. I remember it well. And we lived alongside Jewish refugees from the Nazi death camps. And you can't imagine what it was like living in the same tent, if you like, with people who at night were screaming because of the remembrance of the incredible, incredible, fiendish things that were done to them and their families. We were all waiting to get onto these very small, terribly overcrowded and unsanitary boats. I call them boats because they were mostly very, very small, for that very difficult crossing to Israel. About 1,200 volunteers came from the United States, about 250 volunteered from Canada. From South Africa, with a very small Jewish community. I've got any South Africans here? All right. I want to give great credit to the South Africans. A country with a very small group of Jews, 800 volunteers came to Israel. America with 5 million, 1,200. So you can see what the South Africans did was quite exceptional. 650 from Great Britain, 500 from the rest of Europe, from France and Belgium, 250 from South America, 250 from North Africa, and other groups as well. In total, actually, volunteers came from 40 different countries to help the Jewish state in her time of great need. Now, I've heard some stories, too, that we were mercenaries. My pay was 5 Israeli pounds, lirot, pounds a month, 5. It was just enough, I figured out, to buy myself a couple of egg sandwiches, a soda, and maybe a couple of candy bars. That was what my five lirot a month would bring. So we certainly didn't do it for the money. the majority of the Machal volunteers were basically, you know, had been in World War II. They were veterans from World War II, and they brought with them an amazing amount of expertise. They had combat experience. They knew about, you know, command and control. They had been in armies, and they knew how to fire all these weapons. My unit had so many experts who knew about every single weapon you could imagine that we finally had to borrow, steal, or get from the enemy, and were able to take care of it. Machalnik served in every branch of the service, in many key positions of command. And 200 of the volunteers were doctors, and we have some doctors here, doctors and nurses who served in hospitals and in frontline MASH units. And 425 of the Machal volunteers formed the new Israeli Air Force. You know, the Israeli Air Force was made up 95% of the Machal volunteers because there had been no opportunity for the Israelis really to learn to fly, certainly not combat planes. I mean, they could fly Piper Cubs and so forth and so on, but the Brits wouldn't allow them to fly anything more serious than that. So 95% of the air crews were made up of Machal volunteers. And in fact, somewhat to the chagrin of the Israeli top brass, the official language of the Israeli Air Force all through the War of Independence had to be English, because the pilots only spoke English. They're from South Africa, from the States, from Canada, from Britain. They spoke English. So, without exaggeration, I'd have to say that Machal's contribution was really quite decisive in helping Israel establish a professional army, because in 48, when Israel declared its independence, it did not have a professional army. It had an army that dealt with guerrilla tactics. It knew how to, you know, fight at night and so forth and so on. But it had never faced tanks and planes and modern equipment. Now, when I got to Israel, I was in combat. And in fact, I was in combat for 2 weeks before I even had a rifle. And I had to borrow a rifle to go out on patrol. Can you imagine that? Can I borrow your rifle? I promise I'll give it back when I get back from patrol, if I'm still here. Had to borrow a rifle. Eventually, we got rifles flown in from our... We had a base in Czechoslovakia, Zatec, where we had a base, where we had pilot training with the Czechs and so on. That's another story. And they flew in all manner of weapons for us, including rifles. My rifle was a German Mauser with a swastika on the stock, a swastika. And you know something? As horrible as that is, I was glad to have it. It was I finally had a rifle that I could call my own and defend myself with, and so on. Now, I was in an anti-tank unit. My first anti-tank weapon was made of wood and called Woody. And there's a picture in my book about that, too, named Woody. And as dopey as this sounds, we took turns in throwing grenades in front of Woody to make the Egyptians, who were just over the way, think we had a real weapon. You see, they would see the flash and hear the noise of throwing grenades in front of Woody, and they thought it was a real weapon. Well, they didn't. They weren't fooled, I'm sure, for one moment. But my unit finally got some real, artillery weapons in rather an unorthodox way. Although, as I reread my book recently, this thing happened kind of more than once. We got from, Israeli intelligence, and we were on Hill 113, where some very tough fighting was going on. And we were dug in, Hill 113. And we asked a local Palmach unit, and they were the really tough troops, the Palmach. If you needed something done, you call for the Palmach. And we asked them if they could make a diversionary attack on Hill 113, because we heard there were two British 6-pound artillery guns, and the Brits had some pretty good artillery, which they had given to the Egyptians. The Palmach took the hill after some fierce fighting, and in the ensuing confusion, we were able to liberate the two 6-pounders. We finally had some real anti-tank guns, and the 4th Troop, Gudud Anti-Tanki, was ready for action. Now, in those early days, it was really touch and go whether Israel would survive, General Montgomery, who the hero of El Alamein defeated Rommel, he said, you know, publicly, you know, the Jews are going to be defeated in 2 weeks by the vastly superior, you know, Arab armies and so on. And it looked that way. It looked as though Israel might really be defeated. Israel needed a miracle. And as Ben-Gurion, who had, interesting phrases, as Ben-Gurion said at the time, a Jew who doesn't believe in miracles is not a realist, which I thought was kind of a cute remark to make. We were outgunned and outmanned, but Israel had kind of a weapon. It wasn't the atom bomb. The Israelis, and those of you who know Hebrew, it was called Embrera, which means no alternative. Put more starkly, it meant win or be wiped out. And if Israel was wiped out, that was the end of the Jewish state. If the Arab countries, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, lost the war, it didn't matter. They would just retire, wait 4 or 5 years, gather their strength back, and attack again. And they've been doing that for the last 60 years. You know, wait it out, and we'll have another go as soon as we're strong enough. So now we celebrate Israel's statehood almost, you know, for another year. What is it, 62 years now? It's close, anyway, 62 years. I'd like to share the comments of Prime Minister Rabin, one of my personal heroes, Zichrono Livracha. He dedicated the Machal Memorial. We have a memorial just outside of Jerusalem where some of the heaviest fighting took place at a place called Sha'ar Haggai. And if you're in Jerusalem, please visit Sha'ar Haggai where we have our memorial. And this is where he said the following. He said, Machal, the volunteers of Machal were a special group, a group of people, Jews and non-Jews, we had non-Jews of course, to come to volunteer in the service of the newly born state of Israel, in the newly organized Israel Defense Forces, and to contribute far beyond their number to our capability to fight in the most decisive war of all the wars that the state had experienced, our war of independence. The war that its results decided if we will be or will not be a Jewish state. We were called Machal, and our Israeli colleagues really welcomed us, and were very grateful of our help and assistance. But frankly, they couldn't understand why we would go and volunteer and fight in a war that far away. And we were known as Machal, you know, the volunteers from outside of Israel. And they said, no. Machal really stands for Mishuganim Michutz La'aretz, those crazy guys from overseas. Am I doing okay on time, folks? I know how busy you are.
Yeah. 10, 15 minutes.
Oh, okay. I want to tell you about the Hebrew passwords. To fool the Arab enemy, we were given passwords. They were given in Hebrew, and typically they were given from the prophet Isaiah. They picked Isaiah. They liked Isaiah. They were in Hebrew, and we had to memorize these passwords. And I remember that one day I forgot the password completely, and then you hear the bolt of the rifle of the sentry, you know, and you, my God, what do I do? And one time it happened to me. I forgot the password, and I shouted out the only Hebrew I could remember, which was Eifo HaBeit Shimush. Do any of you know Hebrew? It means, where's the loo? Where's the toilet? Anyway, they figured no Arab would say Eifo HaBeit Shimush, and I was okay. But there was an even more serious incident. Asa Weizmann was flying alongside Milton Rubenfeld, a former U.S. Navy pilot and a Machal volunteer. And Rubenfeld was flying one of these terrible German called an Avia 199. It was kind of a bad copy of the Messerschmitt 109. Dreadful plane. A lot of our pilots were killed trying to fly this thing. Anyway, his engine cut out. What else? And he bailed out above Kfar Witkin. He was about to hit the ground, and he noticed that the kibbutzniks were carrying pitchforks. Evidently, there had been an Egyptian pilot flying a Spitfire that had been bombing and strafing their kibbutz for a number of weeks. And as he was coming down in, you know, on the parachute, they thought this was the Egyptian pilot and they were going to get their revenge. And they were carrying pitchforks. And Israeli kibbutzniks are tough guys. Okay. And he thought they might just skewer him somewhat. So desperate times call for desperate measures, and he shouted out the only Yiddish he knew. Shabbos gefilte fish, Shabbos gefilte fish. He was from New York. Now, these sound like made-up stories. They're not. I mean, I knew these guys. This really did happen. Now, the main negative for me is, and the reason that I wrote my book and that I give talks and I have a Machal website, so if you have my card, you'll know there's also a Machal website that you can go online and kind of take a look and see some of the stories and so on, that the Israelis, as I say, wouldn't let the press talk about the volunteers at all. And even after the war, very little was spoken about the volunteers. And I don't want to get into why I think that was so. There may have been some perfectly legitimate reasons, but there was some reason that went to pride, I guess. Anyway, I'll leave that where it is. But for whatever, we were the best. I think I've got a couple little posters there. We were the best kept secret of the War of Independence. And, you know, more's the pity, because this was a band of dedicated men and women, Jews and non-Jews, a small number relatively, but they gave to the Israelis, who didn't have a regular army, really the expertise that helped them become a professional army and so on. And I want to give credit to the Americans who in synagogues and in board meetings and in groups like this would say after the main meeting was over, let's talk about how we can raise some money and send some weapons, send some guns, send some planes that will help these fighters defend the state of Israel. And there was an underground operation, as I say, to get the money, the munitions, the ships, and the planes needed to fight, that we had weapons to fight with eventually. And even the electric food blenders, which we used to dispose of secret documents. We'd stick them in and zip and get rid of anything we thought was highly secret. Yeah, we had the latest technology. Now, I'm sure some of you have been in the military, and you know anyway, from family, friends, and from whoever, that war is far from glamorous. And there's a very unglamorous downside for all of us volunteers. The human cost was high for Israel, incredibly high for Israel, and it was high for us too, because we had, out of our small number, 122 Machalniks were killed in action, including four women volunteers were killed in action. Casualties particularly high among our pilots, because there were terrible planes in the main that we had to fly. We had our share of wounded, and I have to tell you, my elder brother Ivor, who got there ahead of me, was very seriously wounded at the Battle of Fallujah in the Negev, and to this day he has a machine gun bullet in his chest, which they couldn't take out because it was killing him if they tried, still in his chest as a not so fond souvenir of fighting in the Negev. For the first time since the Romans destroyed Jerusalem in 70 of the Common Era, the Jewish people now had a homeland of its own. And after serving Israel in its hour of need, most of the Machal volunteers, including myself, I wanted to stay in Israel. I didn't speak, my Hebrew was pretty lousy. I didn't have a trade. I was 16 years old, for heaven's sake. I needed to go back to school and learn a trade, and then I'd go back. Well, history, you know, things happened, and I wasn't able to. But about 500 of the volunteers either stayed or decided to go back and make Israel their permanent home. And now their children, because I'm in touch with them, and their grandchildren serve in the IDF and help to keep Israel safe from her many enemies. Kol hakavod to them all. Now, as a grandparent with a wonderful family, I can say that families are very important. Children and grandchildren are very important. But if I can speak for the Machal volunteers, for all of us, being part of Israel's rebirth after a 2,000-year exile remains the single most memorable and important act of our lives, when ordinary people behaved in the most extraordinary fashion. Ben-Gurion said it best, "This was not a war won by heroes, it was a war won by ordinary men and women rising above themselves." And because I wanted to tell the story of these Machal volunteers, before no one was left to tell it, I wrote my book. It began as a simple memoir of the activities of my unit, the anti-tank unit, but it grew to cover the entire War of Independence. It includes scores of photographs, excerpts from the then Palestine Post, which are interesting reading in themselves, and some truly amazing stories of both the hardship and valor of these volunteers, their personal stories. I sent ads to all the Jewish newspapers around the English-speaking world, and I got stories back, in longhand, in letters, eventually by email, by phone call, of many of these volunteers who sent me their stories and their photographs, and they're included in this book. So I hope you'll take a moment, at least just rifle through it. You might even find the names of some people you know in the index in the back. I hope you'll take a look. And finally, as I look back, we the Machal volunteers owe Israel far more than Israel owes us. Golda Meir told us in 1948 that we had to have faith that a miracle would happen. And she was right. For just as we say each Hanukkah, in remembrance of those earlier Maccabees who saved the Jewish state from the far more powerful Syrian army, we can also say about the modern Israelis, the Israeli Maccabees, who saved the new Jewish state. Nes Gadol Hayasham, which means a great miracle did happen there in 1948, and we the Machal volunteers can be justifiably proud, for we were part of that miracle. Thank you very much.
So much.